When you speak in English, you're supposed to start your class by saying "so not "so hum." So. What? You want to know about the Eco Village? The Eco Village is it's a project. It's actually the idea is to bring people from the West to a village, and they're growing, you know, the beautiful nursery. They're growing all their own plants. They're building as far as possible with local materials and self-sufficiency. They have a swimming pool, an Ayurvedic center. They have a conference center, an auditorium, conference rooms, and clean air, which is rare in India. So it's a project aimed to attract Western people, but now the local Indians are going there and they fill it up every weekend. What I've been doing lately in a lot of the programs, and what I like to do, unless devotees have a specific topic for me, I like to ask devotees for questions, because then I know what you want to hear about. And if you don't have any questions, I'll ask the questions that I think you should ask. But first I'll let you ask. So, of course, your question could be, could you speak about this topic? That's also okay. But I like questions and answers, because we usually wait to the end of the class for questions and answers, and there's never enough time. So, yes, we have a question.
I heard that you're giving a forgiveness seminar, and unfortunately, I won't be able to come next week for the seminar.
Can you sum up?
What?
Can you sum up?
Sum up the 20 hours in one word?
Can you just give a little bit for me?
The essence of the forgiveness seminar is the problem is never outside, it's always inside. So we're trying to forgive somebody for something they've done to us, and we're looking at them as the problem, but our reaction is the problem. So we have to look at ourselves, how we're reacting, why we're reacting, and then learn from that, and then learn to be more compassionate. Compassion is the real thing. I'll tell you something interesting. Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote a book, it's called Jiva Dharma. And Jiva means of the soul, or the jiva, and Dharma means his duty. So he said, when you have affection for God, it's called bhava. When you have affection for people in this world, it's called doya, or compassion. And he said, in between humility and compassion is forgiveness. When you mix them together, you get forgiveness. Interesting. And so he defined humility. He said, in relation to forgiveness, he said, a devotee thinks, what right do I have to cause pain to anybody else? Because when you're resentful, it's anger. And you're resentful in order to get back or to punish. So the devotee thinks, what right do I have to hurt anybody? That's humility. And the compassion is, I don't want to hurt anybody. I want to help. So in the middle of that is forgiveness. What do you think of that? When something comes to you negative, like someone doesn't like you or someone hurts you, our natural response is to give back the same thing. Right? You fight fire with fire, we say in America. What do you say in Israel? Same thing? Fight fire with fire.
Eye for eye.
Eye for an eye. Tooth for a tooth, yeah. But one who's practicing spiritual life, he's compassionate. So he responds, something negative, he responds with something positive. Supposed to. Or someone who's pure, that's how they respond. So someone hurts us, we respond with forgiveness or compassion or service. We're supposed to. How dare you say that to me? You don't know who I am. Apologize. That's the normal response. And when you're very advanced and somebody says something to you bad, you say, thank you. Thank you for helping me. Husbands, that's what you're supposed to say to your wives when they say something to you that you didn't want to hear. Thank you for your advice. So the false ego, the function of the false ego is to assert itself that I'm right. Right? You ever get in an argument?
Especially
and you wouldn't... What?
Especially the time of anger.
Yeah, especially when you're angry. You know how you get in an argument and you won't back off? And the argument's over and you're still talking about how wrong the other person is? So that the ego needs that. So in a certain stage of spiritual life, you don't need that anymore. Even if you're right, it doesn't matter. What do you think? It's when I became a devotee, I was a hippie. And I thought if I chant Hare Krishna, I'll get high. And it's cheaper. I don't have to smoke marijuana. The price was going up at that time. Ganja, what do you call it here? Ganja?
Grass.
Grass? Weed? So, all the hippies are thinking, if we chant Hare Krishna, we'll get high. And so we join the temple thinking, wow, what a great way of life. We'll chant and get high. But then you realize, after you've lived in the temple a few weeks, there's a whole philosophy around this, that you need to be pure. You don't chant just for yourself. And so you start hearing these high ideals. You should be like this. A pure devotee thinks like this, he acts like this. And then you start thinking, I got more than I bargained for. Any of you have that experience? Like these high ideals. And it doesn't mean that immediately we can achieve them, but it means that's where we're going. That's the direction we're going. That means we understand this is how I should behave. This is the proper way to behave. And then we begin to think, well, what is the consciousness of a person who behaves that way? If a person can chastise a pure devotee or blaspheme or criticize, and he says, thank you, you're my friend. What consciousness creates that? So we begin to think and look at that and understand. As Bhakti Siddhanta said, if you criticize me, you're my friend. He saw that as helpful, to remain humble. So we have these high ideals, which seem so far away from our natural human condition, right? And sometimes we say, it's too much, I can't do that, it's impossible, it's unrealistic. You ever think like that? Well, that's a pure devotee, but that's how they act. But you can't expect me to act that way. But Prabhupada expected us. He had very high expectations. Did you know that? Prabhupada was very, very idealistic and had very high expectations. Do you know this story? One day he woke a devotee up at like 1 in the morning or 2 in the morning. And he called the devotee into his room. He sent his servant and he called the devotee into the room. And Prabhupada said, it's 2 in the morning or 1 in the morning. He said, what are you doing? He said, Prabhupada, I was sleeping. Prabhupada said, why are you sleeping? I'm not sleeping. I'm up writing books. Why aren't you up writing books? He said, Prabhupada, because you're a pure devotee and I'm not. Why are you not a pure devotee? So, these high ideals were not meant just as stories. Well, you read about the great devotees, it's just a story. No, it was meant to teach us that that's the goal, that's where we're meant to go. That's how we're meant to be. You know, an interesting story is Ambarish Maharaj. I think most of you know the story. Ambarish Maharaj, he didn't satisfy Durvasa Muni, and Durvasa Muni got angry. And you don't want to get Durvasa Muni angry, because if you get Durvasa Muni angry, he might kill you. Do you know those kind of people that you don't want to get angry, but they might kill you? Well, he was one of them. But he was a sadhu, he was a Muni, but sometimes he would get angry, and then he could curse you. So he cursed Ambarish Maharaj. And he created, out of his mystic power, kind of monster that would kill him. Because he had that power. And then Lord Vishnu sent his Sudarshan Chakra to destroy this demon and then go after Durvasa. Then Durvasa ran from it. Because Krishna was protecting his devotee. Anyway, Durvasa went all the way to Vishnu, said, please protect me. And he said, go back to Durvasa and beg forgiveness. So he went back to Durvasa Muni. He went back to, I'm tired, you have to forgive me. He went back to Maharaj Ambarish. And he said, please forgive me. And Ambarish Maharaj said, for what? You didn't do anything wrong. And at that point, Ambarish understood, Durvasa Muni understood, here's a pure devotee. This is what a pure devotee is. And then Ambarish said, come in, I'll feed you. Now, try to understand something, how amazing this story is. Could you invite someone to your house for breakfast who a half hour earlier tried to kill you and serve them and feed them? Would you like more of this? Would you? I don't think so. You might have to ask your wife what she thinks. I don't think she would approve. Do you? He just tried to kill me. Can we invite him in for breakfast? So it's amazing, isn't it? You think about it. What is going on in the consciousness, in his consciousness, that he doesn't see an offense, and he's so forgiving that he can serve this person? You know, in Indian culture, when you invite someone in your house, you treat them like God. So now he's treating him like God. And you read that story, and it's just, as we say in America, it's off the charts, isn't it? That's off the charts. forgiveness. That's off the charts tolerance. It's off the charts compassion. But it's there. And why is it there? It's because it shows us. That's when you're Krishna conscious, that's how you act. There's another really interesting story. I don't know if you picked up on this. But there's a story you may know about Jayanvijay and the four Kumaras. The four Kumaras were little boys. Not that they're little boys. They were old men who kept themselves as young boys. They were the sons of Brahma, so they were the oldest. So, there are four men who wanted to remain celibate and didn't want to get married, and their father wanted them to get married. So their plan was they would keep themselves, because they had the power, they would keep themselves as five-year-old boys so they couldn't marry. He could try to force them, but they couldn't because they were only five. So because they were five-year-old boys and they went to Vaikuntha, Jayanvijay thought they got in Vaikuntha by some accident or they cheated or some way they shouldn't be there. You know, like a child gets in somewhere and you say, get out, you shouldn't be here? Well, that's what Jayanvijay, who let you in here? So they said, Jayanvijay said, you're not fit to be here. And the four Kumaras said, you're not fit to be here. You know that? They both said the same thing. And then Krishna came out. He said, there's quarrels going on between them. Who are you? What right do you have to come into the spiritual world? Who are you? What right do you have to stop us? You don't know who we are. You don't belong here. You're not qualified to be gatekeepers. No, you don't belong here. Who let you in? You must have snuck in through an unlocked door. Then, at a certain point, when the four Kumaras were ready to curse Jayanvijay, they understood they had made an offense. And they asked forgiveness. And then Krishna came out and he asked the four Kumaras for forgiveness for his servants who committed offense to them. And then when the four Kumaras, when the Jayanvijay asked for forgiveness, the four Kumaras could understand the exalted nature of Jayanvijay and they asked Jayanvijay for forgiveness. So through this whole story, you have all this agitation, but it ends up that everybody's asking everyone else for forgiveness. Did you know that in that story? That's how it ended? I'm sorry, please forgive me. No, I'm sorry, please forgive me. Krishna saying, I'm sorry, please forgive my servants. Did you know that? That's how the story went? It's interesting, isn't it?
But at the end they were cursed.
What? That was after they got, yeah. Well, they got cursed and then they were cursed, but then they sobered up after the curse and they realized they actually done something wrong. And when they sobered up, then the four Kumaras realized that actually they were very elevated by the way they took the curse. They accepted it, and so it changed them. So, you know, there's this anger was there, but it didn't last very long. It immediately turned into, oh, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. Please excuse me. So, you know, these examples are there in the scripture of how to behave. And they are our ideals. This is what we look at as in examples. Yes.
From this last example, we can see how pure devotees behave. And then you indicated this is the way how we should behave. So that the should behave should bring us to the platform of those who are behaving, not should, but behaving. In other words, their behavior was spontaneous, fit to their exalted nature. Like in the Four Commands, they saw the transformation of Jai. So how, by following in the footsteps or in terms of should, how we attain the level for?
How does the should become? How by following when you're not there in your consciousness, how does that get you there? Does everybody someone not understand the question? Saying, in other words, it could be artificial. Is that what you mean? You're doing it artificially. Like two kids. Apologize. No. Say you're sorry. No. I won't give you candy if you don't say you're sorry. Okay, I'm sorry. So you know they're not sorry, right? They just said they're sorry, so they can get the candy. So yeah, that it could be like that. But there's the other side. In that all of in bhakti, everything begins as a practice. You know, because it's interesting. You have the third verse of Shishastakam, which says you should chant in a humble state of mind. To which you could reply, I'm not humble yet. Right? You say, well, I'm not humble. So how do I chant in a humble state of mind if I'm not humble? I mean, it could be similar to your question. Right? So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur explained it. He said, when you want to do something, and you feel incapable of doing it, you ask other people to help you. I cannot do this on my own. Could you help me? Right? Said in the same way, chanting in a humble state of mind, the devotee thinks, Krishna, I cannot do this on my own. I cannot chant properly. I cannot be Krishna conscious. I need your help. So maybe humility has not fully manifested, but it's an attitude which even a young devotee can have in their chanting. So it has to start somewhere. Then you say, what if it's artificial? Then we say, what's the option? Don't be humble? Don't try to be humble? Is that an option? We try, yeah. This is my realization. This is one of the things I've noticed in my own spiritual life, that one of the obstacles to developing any of these qualities of a Vaishnava, one of the biggest obstacles is we don't want them. Like, you want to be humble? Come in my room, I'll make you humble. I'll chastise you for an hour. You want that? Do you really want that? Some devotee might say, yes, I do. That would help me. But most of us would say, no, could you praise me? I'd rather have that. Could you encourage me? Acknowledge me? I may not be ready to look at all my faults. That's not something I want. But in the process of devotional service, you come to a position where certain qualities that maybe you weren't attracted to become attractive and you want them. So I had a realization. I don't know if I told you this before. It's a very interesting realization. In looking at conflict amongst, looking at conflicts that would come up within our organization, I began thinking, Srila Prabhupada should have spoken about humility more because it would help solve the conflicts. And I was thinking, he didn't speak about it much. So I went to the Veda base. And the Veda base is all of Prabhupada's books, and you can search by any word how many times that word comes up. So I put in the word humility where I thought Prabhupada did not speak enough about it. And I found it 6,700 times, that word. Or maybe not that much, maybe 1,700 times, a lot. And so I began thinking, how come I missed it? How did I miss it? We know the answer. When you don't want something, you don't see it. Have you ever noticed that? As soon as you want something in spiritual life, you kind of notice it, and it comes to you from other people. You see it in the books. You get the realization. So part of the process of devotional service is that as you're progressing or advancing, the desire to develop higher qualities becomes stronger. You're more receptive to it. You're more open to it. Have you noticed that in your own life? And if we're resistant to it, it can be on every page of every book you read, and it's just in one ear, out the other. So let me tell you the story of why this I don't know if you call it a realization, but this curiosity came about humility. One day I was in Vrindavan, and a sannyasi came into the temple. He was an elderly sannyasi from another mission, a devotee, Vaishnava. And he walked in the temple about 11 o'clock, and very few people are in the temple. And as we know, sannyasis are honored. So if a sannyasi, especially a senior elderly man, comes into a temple, there'll be some honor given to him. Oh, it's a sannyasi from Gaudiya Math, senior. So he came in at 11 o'clock because nobody was there. He didn't want to attract any attention to himself. So he walked in the temple. And just by seeing how he was walking, I could tell he did not want to attract attention to himself. I don't know if you've noticed how people walk, but you could notice how some people walk, they want to attract attention to themselves. Have you noticed that? And how some people walk, they don't want to attract attention. Have you ever noticed how Chinese people walk? Any of you? You don't have Chinese people here?
Small steps.
Small steps and kind of... Should I demonstrate? This is how they walk.
Side of the road.
They walk a little bit like this. There's a sannyasi, he's an Asian sannyasi, and he stayed in Mayapur for about a month, and he used to chant his rounds like this. He'd walk like this. In his 70s. And I'd walk behind him because I could see that he was humble. And if I thought, if I just walk like him, at least maybe I'll think like a humble person. But it was, you can tell. You know, they say the face is the index of the mind, but you can also often tell the way people walk, what's their whole demeanor. So his demeanor emulated humility. You could see he was not trying to attract attention to himself. The way he was presented himself, he was actually trying to be invisible. I could see that. He didn't want anybody to notice him. And it had a very big effect on my heart. And I said, yes, this is it. This is the essence. Humility is the essence. It just struck me like that. This is it. And some desire hit me, some attraction by seeing him hit me that I want to be humble. And then I thought, why didn't Prabhupada speak more about humility? I missed the 1700 or I don't know how many, probably 1700 times. 1700 times he spoke about it, I missed it. So I realized at that point, in our progress in spiritual life, there will be a time when a desire comes to be a certain way, and that is when we'll be receptive and open to it. And the more we're receptive and open to that, the more easily we can develop those qualities, whatever it is. I'll give you another example. You know, many of you know, that maybe 7 or 8 years ago, Satchinandan Swami began doing japa retreats. And it's kind of interesting if you think about it. Let's say 7 years ago means 7 years ago means 2005. So that was, what, 40 years since the beginning of ISKCON? Right? 1965? 2000, 40 years. In 40 years, there was nobody was teaching anything about japa. I mean, there were no programs. You just get your beads, you go, you start on this bead, when you get to this bead, you turn around and go the other way. And that was the only instruction you got for chanting. Right? That was it. You're lucky if you even got shown that. You know? Here, just take the beads, chant. So for 40 years, no one was instructing. You think, why? And then all of a sudden, so many devotees were instructing. And I was one of them, and one of the realizations I had was, now devotees are interested in improving their japa, and so there's a shift. The teachers come when the students are ready. There's a greater interest, there's a greater hunger, there's a greater desire to improve in this, and now it's happening. But apparently it wasn't such a strong desire before. No one even thought of doing it. Isn't that interesting? Now there's so many devotees traveling teaching about japa. But before 2005, nobody was teaching. It's interesting, isn't it? From the perspective of the teacher, we see now devotees are interested in improving their chanting. And it's they created the teachers by their desire. At least that's how I took it. Prabhu, I'm not humble. And I don't want to be. That's not a good position. I'm not humble, but I want to be. That's the position. It's okay if we're not humble, but it's not okay if we don't want to be. It's okay if we're not forgiving, but it's not okay if we don't want to be. That's where the problem comes. Because where we're at now is not the problem. We can be anywhere, but what we desire to achieve, that's what will give us success. Or will cause us to fail. There's one man, he came to see Prabhupada. He had a darshan with Prabhupada. And he was telling Prabhupada, he said, I want to be a pure devotee. Prabhupada was so pleased that he had that desire, that aspiration. He said, this is a very good desire. This is wonderful. He was really, really happy that a person had a desire. I want to be a pure devotee. So just that ambition, I want to be pure. That's so pleasing to Prabhupada, so pleasing to the Guru, pleasing to yourself, to your heart, just the desire And why? Because we could have so many desires for personal gratification. Right? You could desire so many things. I want to be humble. I want to be a servant. I want to be pure. What a wonderful desire to have. So even if we're not pure, the desire is pleasing. Right? Does that make sense? Yes. Material desire stronger than the desire to be Krishna conscious. Yeah,
yeah, sometimes.
Okay.
Up and down.
Yeah. It's a very good. This is.
Yeah,
it's a very good point. It's a very good point. So everybody, listen. I'm going to say something that's worth listening to. Are we ready? One, two, three. Listen. It's such an important point. Material desires are not the problem. Because when we take birth in this world, we're continuing from where we left off. And so we come in with a lot of desires. And it's normal and it's natural. The problem is when we allow those desires to divert us from our intention to be Krishna conscious. And let's say, the desires are big, the desires are strong. Okay, that's fine. But they don't have to divert you from your desire to be Krishna conscious. But the mistake we make is that they do, and then we allow them to. Does that make sense? You can have material desires and not act on them. They can just be there. And they will be there as long as we're conditioned, as we all know. But the mistake we make is that we feel, because they're there, I must act on them. And that's when we say, Prabhu, I'm trying, but. The but is the material desires are getting in the way, or the whatever it is. It's not a desire, it could be something else, something that's pulling us down. And we allow it to affect us. As opposed to, I'm just like, you want to go from here to Tel Aviv, and there are detours on the road, it's raining, whatever, it's snowing, so many problems. Okay, but we're going to go there anyway. So it's going to be a little rough ride, but we go there. So material desires are the same thing. Okay, they're there, but we're going. But some of you say, no, it's too dangerous. We shouldn't drive there. So you don't go. Oh, these material desires are too big. I can't go to Krishna. That's not true. It's only true if you think it's true. There's a wonderful prayer by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. And he makes a very important point. He's praying to Krishna. He's saying, Krishna, I have this desire to serve you. He said, but I also have material desires. And they keep, you know how material desires work. You don't want them, but they're there. So he's expressing that they're there. Somehow or other, they're there. I don't want them, but they're there. And he's expressing that even though they're there, it doesn't matter. I'm not going to allow them to deter me because my desire is for you. Very important point, isn't it? Because we normally think because they're there, it will deter me. It's just something that we need to deal with in our own consciousness, that it can be there, and at the same time I can be very determined in Krishna consciousness. It's an interesting idea, isn't it? Otherwise, we say, I can't because. But if that were true, how could you begin Krishna consciousness? Because you begin from that platform where you'll have many desires. And what do? You serve Krishna to please Krishna in spite of the fact that you want to be honored, you want to enjoy whatever, but you do it, say, this is the right thing to do, and you do it. And so the other desires, they kind of just, they can remain on the side. And you've cleared space, so you can, you know, you've cleared the ice off the road, and then you can go forward. That's how we're supposed to think. Because if you think that way, you don't get so discouraged by them. They're just annoyances. They're botherations. But they don't take you off the road. It's just things you have to tolerate. Yes?
Since the mechanism is that you may want Krishna consciousness, and you have still material desires, and the material desires force you.
Seems like it.
Force you to deviate, and then you think, maybe I don't really want Krishna consciousness, because then why I succumb to the material desire? Therefore, I'm not a devotee. I'm not worthy of.
I want
to be Vaishnava, but the fact that my material desires deviate me means I'm not serious, and the fact that I'm not serious means that I don't really want.
Well, it could be also misapplication, because sometimes material desires need to be engaged, not just all or nothing. So that's one aspect. Maybe someone doesn't realize they can engage them. As far as being worthy, simultaneously, no one's worthy and everyone's worthy. How do you become worthy to become Krishna conscious? What's required?
You have to want to.
I think it's more fundamental. You just have to exist. You just have to exist. You have to be a spirit soul, and you're qualified. Did I tell you that story before about the devotee asking Prabhupada about cutting off his finger? Did I tell you that? It's a nice story. So the devotee asked Prabhupada, why would Krishna care about me? I told this story. Why would he care about me? Because he has so many devotees. Do you ever think like that? I mean, he's got the gopis, you know, what am I? I'm out here, you know, listening to rock and roll music, you know, my spare time, you know, trying to fit my rounds in a busy day. What does Krishna care about me? You know, I'd rather read the newspaper than the Bhagavatam. What does he care about me? So Prabhupada replied, if you severely cut your finger, will you try to save it? Will you go to the hospital and try to get stitches to save the finger? Or will you say, well, just go to the doctor and say, just let it fall off because I have 9 other fingers? What will you say? You'll try to save it. He said, so similarly, Krishna doesn't think, well, who cares about you, because I have so many devotees, you can just let him rot off the hand. He doesn't think like that, because every devotee is dear to Krishna. How do you know that? How do you know everyone is dear to Krishna? And how do you know the only qualification to be worthy is to exist, especially exist on this planet? How do you know? Because Krishna came and gave the holy name. And it's through the holy name that you get the relationship. If he didn't care, why would he give it? Why would he empower the holy name with love if he didn't care? Why would all these eternal associates of Krishna come and write books if Krishna didn't care? Why would we have this whole this cyclic succession? Why would Krishna send Prabhupada And why would Prabhupada stay up all night if Krishna and write his books if Krishna didn't care? There's so much evidence that Krishna cares. And my realization is, we don't care. It's not that Krishna doesn't care. We always want to blame it on Krishna. Isn't it? It's us. We're qualified. I mean, he qualified us before we were born. It's just, he wants it. That's our qualification. That we're a spirit soul and he wants a relationship. That's the qualification. So, you know, thinking we're not worthy, in one sense, it is, you could say, a misunderstanding of Krishna's affection. Like if somebody gives you a gift, you might feel you're not worthy, but you accept it. Because it's a gift, and it's the affection of that person. And if you don't accept it, it's like you're saying, I don't like you, isn't it? I mean, someone gives you a gift, no, I don't want it. You don't ever do that. I don't advise doing it. Here, oh, it's the wrong color. Take it back. So Krishna is giving you this gift. And you say, no, I'm not worthy. No, it's not what he wants. Or you say, I'm not worthy. And Krishna says, I already know that. But that doesn't matter. You see? If you were worthy, I wouldn't give you this Maha Mantra because it's too easy. This is for all the people who aren't worthy. So it's not a question you're worthy or not. It's just a question that Krishna wants you. I was giving a class in India. So we were at a college and the principal of the college was there attending. At the end of the class he said, I forget what I was talking about. I must have been talking about something in relation to getting out of the material world. And he said, well, what's the problem if I do good karma and I'm happy and I come back life after life? I do good work and I'm happy, so why not just stay here? I'm not hurting anybody and I'm doing good work. And I said, because Krishna wants you. Krishna wants you to come back to him. He's waiting for you. And the lights went off in his head when I said that. And he came up to me afterwards and he said, you made me realize that Krishna's waiting for me. And that's how we should think. So, worthy, not worthy, that's all getting in the way of the fact that Krishna's waiting for me. He's waiting for all of us. In the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, Gop Kumar goes back to Godhead, and what does Krishna say? Why'd you take so long? why'd you make me wait for you? So now we're here in the material world. What did Prabhupada say we're doing in the material world? He said we're loitering. The word loitering means just hanging out, doing nothing. In America, we say putzing around. Whereas putzing around means like some old guy, your grandparents, they got nothing to do, so they like clean things that don't need to be cleaned, make phone calls that don't need to be made because they're bored. So that's called putzing around.
And they have their Facebook and the internet.
Yeah. Putzing around on Facebook. You have nothing to do. You're putzing around. So we're in the material world putzing around. Loitering. And Krishna's saying, I've got a place for you. Actually I have a form. Your form is ready and your service is ready. You have a name and a color. Everything is there. It's waiting for you. And you're down here putzing around. What's so important? What are you doing down here that's so important? Oh, no, but I'm not worthy. No, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Krishna wants you. That's all that matters. He takes you as you are. So that's the idea. If Krishna wants us, then we should do the process to get back. And not worry about whether we're worthy or not. Just understand he wants us. He'll take us as we are. That's enough. That's all we need to know. We're never going to be worthy. It's not his requirement to be worthy. If we were worthy, we wouldn't be here, would we? Why would you end up here if you were worthy? You'd already be there. When I was in Mayapur, Jananibas was giving a class, and he said, Krishna's on the altar playing the flute. He said, but there's a problem here. Radharani is next to Krishna, and he plays the flute to call the gopis, but she's already there. And the, you know, in Mayapur, the Astashakis are there, so all the gopis are there. So he said, he doesn't need to play the flute, because they're already there. He said, he's playing it for us, to call us. So when you see Krishna playing his flute, he's playing it to call you and me. He said, and his flute sings a song. It says, stop putzing around. You heard the fifth note, you know? The Bhagavatam describes the fifth note. Well, that's what the fifth note says, stop putzing around. What are you doing down there? You know, you go back to Godhead and, Krishna's going, what were you doing down there for so long? I mean, you know, it's not that interesting down there. You know, what's wrong with you? You kept me waiting up for so long. So,
I was preaching.
Okay, if you're preaching, it's okay. He's a bodhisattva, so he's going to stay many lifetimes here. Preach. Krishna is called Rasaraj. So Rasaraj means the king of rasa, relationship. So Krishna thrives on relationship. So that's what he wants. So if Krishna wants a relationship with you and me, you can't deny it and say, I'm not worthy. That would be like someone giving you the gift and denying it, wouldn't it? He wants the relationship, oblige it. I'm not qualified. That's okay, I want the relationship. You know, you might be Bill Gates, or you might be the king, or what happened, right? The Prince Charles, or Prince whoever he was, married some, what they call, commoner, right? Oh, he married a commoner. Whoa. He wanted to do it. She didn't refuse. Well, I'm just a commoner, don't marry me. No, I want to marry you. So if Krishna chooses us commoners for a relationship, we have to oblige, because that's what he wants. Right? Does that make sense? If Krishna decides a relationship is okay, then what does it matter if you're worthy or not? And who is stupid enough to think they're worthy in the first place anyway? What did I do to deserve to become a disciple of Prabhupada? You know, what great piety did I do? You know? I didn't do any in this lifetime before I met Prabhupada, I can tell you that. Maybe something happened in another life, but this lifetime I don't see anything. I mean, I saw the devotees, that was my piety. The temple was a mile, I grew up and the temple was a mile from my house. That was my fortune. I saw devotees, but I accumulated many sinful activities. And Krishna says, let's dance. Okay, let's dance. You know, Prabhupada said, many times, Prabhupada said, he would give his lecture, you know, and he would end his lectures by encouraging us. And he would sometimes say that someday, said the goal of Krishna consciousness is you'll dance with Krishna. And so he would sometimes say, you'll see Krishna, just like we're seeing one another. You'll dance with Krishna. This is Krishna consciousness. So what are you supposed to say when Prabhupada says that? What are you supposed to say? Nah, I'm not worthy. Not me, I'm not going to dance with Krishna. No way. I'm just going to putz around in the material world. You know? Well, how are you going to become, you know, it's like it's not the way you should think, right? Krishna's calling, okay. Let's go. He's playing his flute, calling us, let's go. So when you chant the holy name, you can think the holy name is Krishna's invitation. Krishna's come in his holy name, it's an invitation to go back with him and accept it. One of the things I teach in the Japa workshop is sometimes all you have to do is accept. You just have to receive the mercy. You don't have to like try to do any great feat, just receive it. Receive Krishna's affection in his calling in the relationship. Now, we have a course on humility where we go into the real side of unworthiness. This was the like shadow of unworthiness. There's the real side of unworthiness, but it comes when you're very elevated, not when you're very low. Because when you become very advanced in Krishna consciousness, you honestly feel that you don't have it and you're not worthy of the relationship. But when you're that advanced, your desire for the relationship is so strong, it creates this dichotomy. You can't not desire the relationship. But that's a different kind of unworthiness, which is not a psychological issue, it's a spiritual issue. So don't worry about that yet. That'll come when you're more advanced. Just worry about becoming more advanced. There's the picture. He's calling. Who wants to go? Raise your hand if you want to go. Plane's leaving soon. Now just think how stupid we are. Krishna's calling us. We're saying, yeah, but, you know, there's a good movie coming out next week. Maybe we are so stupid. Right? Krishna didn't have to come here to the material world. He comes here and he does all these leelas to attract us. He comes for us, right? Everything Krishna did on this planet, everything he did was to attract us. So you could say everything Krishna does is out of affection for us, to attract us back to him.
Now I really feel good.
There's good guilt and there's bad guilt. Good guilt is wanted. If I make you feel guilty so you want to be more Krishna conscious, that's good. If I make you feel guilty so you don't want to be, that's bad. But not that we should feel guilty, but we should feel Krishna's affection. I mean, think. Everything Krishna did in every lila, what's going on there? It's something that can attract our minds and hearts from the mundane to the spiritual, right? Like they say, this Damodar Leela and Krishna's Bal Leela growing up is the most attractive. And it pulls the heart. That's why Krishna does it. Krishna leaves Vrindavan. What happened when he left Vrindavan? The devotees became more attached. And everybody's saying, why don't you go back to Vrindavan? They're dying. But he knows how to pull the heart and create the rasa. He knows what to do, when to go back, when not to go back. That's all he does. Just like Prabhupada would do things to pull the devotees closer to him. Tamal Krishna Maharaj would do things to pull the devotees closer to him. He was expert at that. That's what Krishna does. He's just expert at creating the relationship. So how much evidence do we need that Krishna wants us? It's everywhere. If you read Prabhupada's books and don't read it with your brain, and you just feel it, what will you feel? You'll feel this person wanting his love extending to you. You'll feel Prabhupada at midnight writing and just showering love through his purport. The intellectual part is there, but there's another part to it, which is the love of the guru. What was Prabhupada thinking? He was only thinking how to help the devotees go back to Godhead. That was his meditation. That's it. So there's so much affection coming to us. All we have to do is receive it. Take it. Understand that that's what Krishna is giving. Right? But Prabhu, no buts. Too many buts, we'll be in trouble. Right? So should we stop? Have kirtan or what? It's getting late? Or question or what? Okay. Late is okay? Okay for you, I don't know about me. But Gop Kumar gave me magic pills, now I'm awake. No, unfortunately I'm not tired. I wish I were. So I'd like to go to sleep now. And here a nice story. I was in Vrindavan and I was speaking to Gopal Das. Gopal Das is in charge with 24-hour kirtan. And he has a house in Mayapur, I'm renting the house. I went to Vrindavan to pay him some rent, and I was in Delhi, so I had a day. So we were hanging out taking prasadam. And he told me a story. He said, students from America, photography students, came to do a photo, to do some photography in Vrindavan, because one of their teachers is a devotee. So they brought them to Vrindavan. And so he brought them around. And these people know nothing about Krishna consciousness. And after 3 days, when they were leaving, they said, Gopal, we have a question. He said, what is this feeling we get here? We had never had this feeling before. So what is that feeling in Vrindavan? What is it? That's Radharani's love and sweetness, isn't it? These people have no connection with Krishna consciousness, and they're feeling this in Vrindavan. They're feeling something that they've never felt before. They can't explain it. So if we see all of these things, like the holy dham, or we see the sadhus, the holy name, prasadam, kirtan, sangha, we see all these things as manifestations of Krishna's affection, because all these things help us, then we always feel this affection and we feel indebted, and then we remember Krishna's waiting for us while we're putzing around here, that we should get moving. You know, stop putzing around, get out the door, let's move. You're trying to get out of the house, but you know, oh, I forgot this, no, I have to put my makeup on, oh, I have to put my nail polish on, no, let's dress as the wrong color, let me change, you know. Let's get out of the door, will you? Let's move. So that's what we're doing in the material world. It's like there's always something in the way. Trying to get out of the door, back to Krishna. No, but. So if we're just aware of how Krishna's showing his affection, then you naturally want to reciprocate, right? Because you're seeing so much how he wants you. So you feel obliged. Okay. Maybe I should actually chant my rounds nicely, because that's what Krishna wants. Maybe I should actually be serious about my spiritual practice, because Krishna's waiting for me, and I don't want to keep him waiting. Maybe somebody could write a song about this. It'd be a nice song. So anything else? Question? Comment? Yes?
Oh, it will be very helpful if you express myself in English.
You want a translator?
No, I'll try. Don't help me. For me, Krishna consciousness, the process, A, it's very, very hard. And B, it seems that it's going to be very, very, very long to get to the goal. Okay? Maybe a few lifetimes. I don't know. So, and sometimes you know, I'm getting, you know, very frustrated by the process, because it's like I have something and it's here and I'm running for it and I'm trying to do this service and this as long as I can, and it's always here. I can't touch it. It's like I'm not there, and I'm just not like. And a lot of times I'm not satisfied because I feel it's just. It's not here. I can't reach it, and it's very, very hard for me.
Why try if I can't reach it?
And it's, I know that it's going to, for me, it's going to be very long to maybe when I'll be old, maybe in another lifetime. So it's like I'm always waiting for something, and it's very frustrating for me.
Uh-huh. Okay. What to do?
Yes.
How to deal with it? It may have to do with what you're expecting it to be. Maybe you have high expectations. Maybe you expect something to happen sooner than it's supposed to. You think?
But I don't have that time. I can't
wait. Can't wait for it to happen?
Yeah, it doesn't have patience. I have to have patience.
Yeah. I think one of the things you can do in light of this discussion is be more appreciative of what you do have and see more. I think you have more than you think you have. And whatever it is you have, appreciate it. And understand that your advancement will happen, but it will happen in Krishna's time. Not in your time. And so it's kind of like you're taking an attitude which is less self-centered and more Krishna-centered. Because it's like, what's about me, I'm not happy and it's not happening fast enough. And then turn it around a little. And take it more from the servant perspective. As Krishna wants, he'll give it. Like, I want a taste, but I'm not getting it. Okay. So that Krishna, he'll give it to me when he wants, and kind of be satisfied about it. Because in that satisfaction and in that appreciation for what you have now, there is taste. And sometimes you evade, you can't get the taste because you so much want it, and your consciousness is so much, I want to get it because I need it, and there's maybe some impure motive there of why you want it, that it evades you, you don't get it. Because when you change your consciousness, okay, Krishna, my goal is to serve you. Even if I don't get the taste, my goal is to serve. What about that idea? If I don't go back to Godhead, my goal is to serve. What about that idea? Immediately you calm down because your expectation changes. One time Giri Rajaswami was saying, we're always thinking, what is the holy name for us? We should also think, what are we for the holy name? You turn it around. Oh, okay. Krishna wants me to chant. I do it for his pleasure. You move your, it's a different way of looking at it. So the expectation is now different. And the result can be immediate. I can chant immediately for Krishna's pleasure. And that's the only result I need. And then the process seems hard because you're not getting the result. So it makes the process seem hard. Where the process is what it is, if you appreciate it, it helps. You know the way psychology works. If you think something's hard, it becomes hard. You know that? If you appreciate it, it becomes sweeter. Just appreciate that you have it. You have the process. How many people in Israel have the process? Are you fortunate? Do you think like that? Or do you think, I want? Then you're removed from... It's like somebody gives you a present, a nice present, but it's not what you want. So you look at the present. Oh. But it's something nice. You can't appreciate it because you wanted something else. They give you a cell phone. You want an iPod. You wanted an iPhone. You didn't get an iPhone. You just got some phone. Oh, a phone. Thanks. So if we can appreciate whatever it is we have, what Krishna's given us.
It's so hard to appreciate it.
But you have to change that hardness. Because you're making it hard for yourself by saying it's hard to appreciate. See what I'm saying? You're approaching it in a way that you're defeating yourself. Appreciation means to be in the present, just accepting. You're fortunate. We're all fortunate. Accept the fortune. Appreciate it. It's not hard to do that. But you might be thinking, but I want to be more fortunate. And then you lose the appreciation. You think you're fortunate?
In a way.
And in what way you're not fortunate?
My mind.
You're fortunate you have this Sangha, right? You're fortunate you have the holy name. You're fortunate you have access to so many books and so many gurus and teachers. I'll tell you a little secret. Maybe you don't know this. Everybody has a mind. And you think yours is worse than everybody else's. And everyone else thinks theirs is worse than yours. Believe me, it's not as bad as you think. And the irony is the mind we have is the mind we've created through all these lifetimes. So it's our own creation. It's not like, hey, I got a bad bargain, I got this mind. Well, guess what? You made it. It wasn't like a random thing where minds were just dropped. You know, in Las Vegas, you know, and you got this mind and she got that mind. But the very mind you have was your own creation through all these lifetimes. And so the irony is, if we don't work to purify our mind, we're reinforcing the problems of the mind into the future or the next lifetime. And then you'll get another body and go, oh, this mind. And they say, well, what's the problem with your mind? Oh, I'm impatient. You know, it's like you're going to be asking this question 100 years from now in another class. You know, if you don't deal with it now, it's true. You know, if you don't deal with it now, I say, I'm impatient. You know, I don't appreciate. You know, how do I deal with it? It's because you have to deal with it at some point. You have to alter the way you perceive, the way you see and relate to Krishna consciousness to a position of more appreciation and a position of more tolerance. Everyone has a mind to tolerate, but it's how we learn to deal with it. And then gradually becomes purified. But the gradual may not be fast enough for you. Or the effort may be too more than you want to put out. But if that's the case, you'll be back in the next lifetime dealing with the same problem. You have to at some point just say, okay, let's do it, right? It's important. So I think appreciation is very, very important for you because it will make you more patient. And try to just see in your life all the things that are good, that are valuable. And don't put but after it. But is a really bad word. What's the Hebrew word for but?
Aval.
Val?
Aval.
Aval? Yeah. Aval?
Aval.
Aval. Cross that word out of your dictionary. It's a bad word. Sometimes I give a lecture, you know, and I analyze something from every point of view, and I try to destroy every doubt and just clear it out. And Prabhu, I have a question. Yeah, you said this, but... And after like an hour lecture, you know, it's like I've taken everything into consideration. There's no buts. There's always someone with a but. And what's the but? The but is a resistance. Isn't it? It's just a resistance. This is the reality and I'm resisting it.
To resisting to what? To surrendering?
To surrendering. Surrendering could be to many things. Appreciation. You know resistance? You fight it. It's coming and you push it. It could even be a resistance to the idea that it's not hard. Or a resistance to the idea that it takes time. Or a resistance to the idea that it is going to be difficult in the beginning. Or a resistance to the idea that I have to do this for Krishna, not for me. What do you think? Maybe? Anyway, think about it. We can talk more. My personal experience is that every problem, the problems we have in spiritual life is because we're still too self-centered. We're still thinking about, am I happy? Am I satisfied? Am I? And that's the disease. When you get to this plane of, is Krishna happy? Is Guru happy? That's when you really become happy. You stop thinking about, am I happy? You don't even, your gauge, you know what a gauge is? Gauge in a car, like the gas. What do you call it? So we have this gauge, am I happy, am I not happy? Right? But when you elevate your consciousness to think about what is pleasurable to Krishna, your gauge gets turned off. You don't need it anymore. It's not relevant whether you're happy or not. Because you're always happy. Because you're not worried about whether you're happy. And the more you're worried about whether you're happy or not, the more you're like looking at the gauge. Oh, the gauge is low. I'm not, you know what I'm saying? You know, I need, you know, why is the gauge low? And then we get all hung up about the gauge being low. Oh, how are you doing today? I'm so depressed, my gauge is low. I'm just looking at that gauge, it's depressing me. Whereas on another level, you're just looking at service and the gauge, you don't look at the gauge anymore. Because it doesn't matter. Does that make sense? So try that, see what happens. Then you won't worry about the result, when it's happening, it's hard, easy, it's just, you're beyond that now. It's just, this is what Krishna wants me to do. Isn't that what Krishna taught Arjuna? Don't worry about if you're successful or not, or happy or not. Just do your dharma. You take it more dharmically. This is what Krishna wants, it's my duty. Okay, is that good? What do you think? Good? Oh, you can. All of you. It's important to understand. And this other point is we reinforce our conditioning and then it remains and then we complain about it. But we created it. And we didn't do anything to purify it and then we complain about it. Oh, my mind. Don't complain about it, purify it. That's more proactive, right? Because complaining won't help. You always want to focus on what you want, not what's wrong. You see the difference? I want to achieve this, as opposed to this is the problem. If you focus on the problem, it gets bigger, and it becomes a negative source. If you focus on what you want, I want purity, I want devotion, I want bhakti. Focus on that, make that your goal.
So you're saying to focus on the things that I want?
Yeah. Be for something rather than against something. No, I'm against my mind, I'm against my materialism, I'm against all this. It's all, your focus is on fighting it off. Focus on what you're for. I'm for purity, service, or whatever it is you're for. It's a more positive force in your life. Does that make sense? Should we stop? What are you for?
Kirtan.
You're for kirtan? Yeah. You like to dance? You know, in Vrindavan, everybody dances. They love to dance in North India. It's very, very ecstatic there. You like to dance in Israel, right? Is that true? Some of you? Anyway, we'll see. Okay, we can stop and have kirtan.